Welcome to Highway Diary. I'm your host, Eric Hollerbach. This is episode 250 of the program with my guest, Sean McDonough.
What's up there, guy?
Well, we tried to schedule this maybe the last time or the second before last Brighton Bar open mic, and then everything shut down, you know?
Yeah.
But yeah. I wanted to do this feel-good story because February 19th of 2020, you started a GoFundMe for the Jester Comedy Company, LLC, operating out of New Brunswick. And you asked for, was it $2,500?
Yes.
And you raised for them $3,035.
Yeah, man.
So, I know things are different now because everything got shut down right after you successfully raised the money. But let me read this. I started this GoFundMe because Angelique and Franco have given me and people like me a place I wouldn't have otherwise. I wanted help, their gratitude for initial donations. They wanted to tell their story. So that's your opening message. What was the money for? How did Jester get in trouble?
So, my understanding of it is that they had a space that was zoned for, I think it was a yoga studio or something like that. Like, it was a commercially zoned space. But at some point during their soft opening, the People's Republic of New Brunswick decided that it was not adequate for live entertainment venue. So they were shut down by the, I believe, the fire inspector and the coding officials. I mean, I could be talking, whether that's 100% accurate as to who from the town did that or not, I'm not sure, but I mean, it's basically the same thing. Essentially, they were told that they needed to get permits and hire an architect to do some renovations, and basically, from what I understand, in talking with Franco and Angelique, I think the main issue is that they didn't have a slop sink.
A slop sink.
Yeah, like a sink for mops. I think that's a big thing that they have to get changed. But
now, why wouldn't a yoga studio need to mop down the floors?
Right, and I don't know, if that was, if the yoga studio had some different level of enforcement, or if the codes changed. Not an extensive background, but I've worked in residential construction, or I guess that would be commercial construction, in the wonderful state of New Jersey, I think there's something like 680 municipalities or something like that, and they all have their own rules. They're all based around, an international building code, but, like, it varies town to town, inspector to inspector, day to day, as far as, getting things up and running for people. So they, I don't think that, I mean, it's a hard thing to understand if you've never done that before, so I don't know if they were unaware of it or what the deal was, but, essentially, they were told that they could no longer operate until they hired an architect and an engineer and had plans drawn and paid for permits and just a whole lot of bureaucracy.
Seems like if you have a good relationship with New Brunswick, then you can kind of grease the wheels, but the bureaucracy can be used as a weapon if you don't know the right people.
I mean, it's like anything else. It's all who you know, and it's not even like as sinister as that on a lot of levels in my experience with it. It's like, I have friends that are contractors that smile and ask the building inspector how their day's going, and they have no problems, And then the other guy who tried to keep it strictly business, everything in the world that's wrong will halt construction on things. And,
let me read so from this GoFundMe, I want people to understand what Jester is, so I'm going to read the mission statement. Originally, we founded our organization as Comedian Services to help performers move forward with their careers. services including, but not limited to, content creation, paid gigs, submission tape recording, tour planning, headshots, album recording, resume building, and rehearsal space for group writing sessions.
Right.
So that's a very unique kind of thing. It's like an artist commune for comedians.
Yeah, and it was awesome. And my sort of, I can give you kind of the backstory of how I ended up involved getting to know Jester and Angelique and Frank over there. So last year I was, so I actually just was thinking about this today. I started doing stand-up. I did stand-up for the first time probably in 2008 or 2009. I did it like two or three times and then kind of just never did it again. And I actually remember what made me quit was I had a joke that I had written, and then a new Daniel Tosh special came out, and he had like the same joke word for word. And instead of me being like, oh man, I guess you write jokes that are good enough for somebody like Tosh to do it, I was like, I'm never going to be able to be the first one to say these things on my mind. And in 2017, I had a sort of traumatic event in my life. My older brother passed away, and I kind of like had one of those like almost like feel good movie moments where I was like, life's too short. I'm going to do everything that I said I was going to do one day. And stand up was always something that like, I always thought I was funny and all that. And then I tried all these different things, you know, and stand up was kind of the thing that eventually, like, again, in 2017, I did it two or three times. And then somewhere around the beginning of 2018, I started doing it on a regular basis. So in the fall of 2019, I moved into a van and drove across the country, which was funny. The highway diaries, like I have actual highway diaries.
Where'd you go, man? So you took off from Asbury Park, and where'd the van go?
So I ended up staying in Corvallis, Oregon. When I got there eventually, whoa, because I had, in 2009, I kind of drank myself out of school my senior year. So I went to go finish my degree, and I took it as an opportunity to go kind of travel, go finish it, live simply. Like I had also kind of fallen into the whole trap of, you know, not even a trap really. It was awesome. But like I had had this idea of like living in a van for fucking years, and I finally just did it. So while I was out there, there was an Instagram account that was called Brian St. John's Mustache. That I don't know if you remember that when that was going on, but there was an Instagram account that was like from the perspective of Brian St. John's Mustache. And it was kind of bumping around with some people I had made friends with in the Jersey comedy community. And I have a mustache. So I took it upon myself to kind of like play the foil to the whole thing. And I just was like vicious on Instagram. It was like a great, like I would look forward to it when I was at class. Like at the end of the day, I would come out and there'd be like this Instagram post, and I was just trying to be funny. And we were going back and forth to the point where like everybody, like a circle of people was all accusing everybody of being the person behind the account. Like, I thought it was one person. People thought that I was behind it. And the big reveal at the end of it, which I think, and I could be wrong, but I think I, like, video called everybody that was involved on Instagram one day. And we found out that it was Angelique, who was the person that was behind the Brian St. John's Mustache account.
So can I ask you a question, Sean? So did you drove from New Jersey to Oregon to do school in Oregon, and you went all through like Detroit on like some kind of vagabond stand-up tour?
So I did comedy on the way out there. I didn't have the time to really hit a bunch of places. On the way out there, I picked up my sister in Chicago, and then we drove on I-90 basically to Olympia National Park in Washington, and then down to Portland. She flew home, and then last year, which I guess was the summer of 19, I left Oregon and drove down to the bottom of California and kind of across the southern part of the country. And there I stopped and did mics and shows in like LA and New Mexico and Arkansas and Tennessee, and did a bunch of shows on the way back. And at that point, actually, Don Harris from Stick Up Comedy was throwing together this sort of like Jersey. I forget, he's going to kill me, but I forget what the name of his festival was. The Garden State Comedy Festival, maybe. And which was this sort of like grassroots festival. It was like at a bunch of different venues, a bunch of different things. And he was down with the idea of me sort of like filming a special or an album, whatever you want to call it. And I had done one before I left Oregon at the club I was working at out there. So we settled on Jester as the venue to do that special, because they were open to the idea. So like that was a big thing for me. It was because they gave me, you know, this was a guy that like, I'm new in comedy, whatever. Like, not that many people know me. Some people did. I had this, you know, half hour that was pretty solid. I tried to stretch it to 45. It didn't like work out the best, but point was, is that Angelique and Franco were totally willing and open to let me do that at their venue by that point.
So
you discovered
that Angelique was behind Brian St. John's mustache in some sort of a investigation. And then, when you got to the New Jersey Comedy Festival, you discovered it was the same people. And
right. And even before that, like that was in August of last year, I think, was the night that I did that. But I got home around July, and at that point Jester was doing like weekly mics, and during the comedy festival too, they did a bunch of like showcases. They actually did, this was probably, no lie, the most fun I've ever had on stage. They did a sort of stand up improv mash together show where somebody went up and did 5 minutes, right?
Mm-hmm.
And it was supposed to be off the top. There was a few people there that they were clearly doing material that I had heard before, but that's neither here nor there. And then after your 5 minutes were done, you would bring up another comedian and you would do 5 minutes together. And then the first comic would get off, and it was just like this daisy chain of doing like 5 minutes. Then you do 5 minutes with a partner. Then they do 5 minutes alone. Then you do 5 minutes with a partner. And it was like the most fun I ever had in my life.
Yeah.
And the atmosphere at the place was great. They had a little soundboard set up. Like, everybody was really supportive. Like, and it was just, it was such a cool thing for me because, like, you know, it was like a place to go where it was like, sometimes you do, depending on the venue or stuff, like, but particularly if you're doing like open mics and stuff around New Jersey, like you've been to them where like there's an open mic in the back of the bar somewhere and the audience wants to like fucking throw their drinks at you because they're like, why are you talking when I'm trying to get drunk?
Right.
So this was like a place where it was like people came with the explicitly because they wanted to be entertained, and it was awesome. So, and they didn't ask for anything from any of the comedians. Like, they had a bucket when you would go there to be like, hey, donate, you know, but it was never like, they weren't making money off of it. It was like something that was obvious to me. It was sort of for like the love of the game.
I want to read this part of the GoFundMe page. It says, "We refuse to allow the gatekeepers to continue starving the artists of what rightfully belongs to them. That's why we're here. We always say that the Content House is a place for comedians by comedians."
Right.
The gatekeepers.
Right. Yeah.
I think that, you know, it's very interesting how in this GoFundMe, it's like there's a mission statement, but also a philosophy on how to run a community of comedians. And that's what you're talking about in the show with daisy chaining together. You work with this person, now you work alone. Now you work with that person, now you work alone. And it, you know, creates this party atmosphere where everyone's in it together, you know?
Right. And I think that, like, and I think it ties into like something. I mean, obviously, like, I'm pretty new to the comedy community, right? Like, I was putting it together today. Like, I guess I've really been active actively participating for about, you know, two and a quarter years, 2 years and 3 months or something like that, that I've been like, you know, this has become something that's like a big part of my life. And, but in that limited amount of time, like I've started to notice things like just in the world as a whole, right? Is that like, you see it with television and movies and, you know, streaming services and all that kind of stuff. And like, you know, you don't need to have, you don't need to have somebody corporate tell you that you're good or not. And you don't have to play like any kind of politics or bullshit with it. Like you can look at people like a great example is like Andrew Schultz, like that guy, you know, whether you love him or hate him, right? Like he always has this story about like, you know, he was a working comedian and he couldn't get anybody to fucking, to, you know, film or and put it out on YouTube. And now like the dude's selling out arenas and shit, you know? So like, you don't need an entertainment industry necessarily in place, like with the internet, you can just do things on your own. And if it's good, it always reminds me of Field of Dreams. If you build it, they will come, right? Like if you're good, they will come. And the cool thing about Jester is like, you know, there is literally not a traditional comedy club in the sense of the word that would have given me 45 minutes ever to go up there and work, you know? Yeah. It just never would have happened.
Yeah, it's like a little workshop content creation place. You know, there's another comedy club in New Brunswick, you know, but they have a very different business model. They bring in headliners from, you know, Los Angeles and Chicago and England and New York City, and they fly them in, and then they have these big shows, and then they fly out, and, you know, and that's it. And but Jester seems like more of a you know, a workshop, like, you know, how to raise people up from zero to headliner.
Right. And I think that like, and I don't think that they're, you know, I don't think that the traditional comedy club thing has to be like at odds with that.
That's interesting.
I don't think they have to be competing things. Like, I think that
they're in different
on
lanes.
Some level. Right. Well, like, it's like, you know, I could use the example of like baseball, right? They have farm teams, you know?
Yeah.
And from a, you know, from a perspective of like another comedy club, right? Like a comedy club, it's funny. I took when I was finishing my degree last year, I had to take a bunch of electives. I had like 10 credits of electives that I needed to take in order to get my bachelor's. So I ended up taking a class on writing business plans, right?
Yeah.
And one of the business plans that I wrote was, because we got, for our final project, we could do whatever we wanted. So I was like, I'm going to write a business plan to open a comedy club in Asbury Park. Because I've always kind of thought, like, Asbury Park has this music scene. You know, why wouldn't we have a comedy club there? And I went into the business side of it and started crunching the numbers. And, like, the amount to get started to have, like, a traditional comedy club, and the amount of overhead that would be necessary in order to staff it and, you know, provide food and all and drinks and all that kind of stuff is like astronomical. So I think calling Jester a co-op is a good thing because it's really just like a place for artists,
right,
to pool the resources together, which was part of the thing that really inspired me to start that GoFundMe, was because, and I'm not trying to get a pat on the back for this, but like, I started that GoFundMe because shortly before that, I sent Jester some money towards their fund. And the reason that I did that was because I saw that they were throwing shows at other places, right? They were throwing these shows at other venues around, you know, I guess central, northern New Jersey, whatever you want to call it. And they were basically saying, like, the show's free, but please make a donation. All the donations will go to the permitting process that we need to open the content house back up. And I had sent them some money, and then my thought was is that if everybody that's gone to that place to perform, you know, 5 minutes, 10 minutes, whatever it is, if all of the comedians that were given an opportunity to perform there threw in $20, they would have more than any, like, more money than they would ever need. So I that was my idea behind doing the GoFundMe, was like, let people feel like that they're like a piece of it, you know?
Yeah. It's interesting that, you know, I was just thinking that ShopRite operates in Edison, and then the George Street Co-op operates in New Brunswick. Now, are they competitors? I'm not sure. Let me read this part of the GoFundMe I thought interesting. We had our soft open of Jester Content House in April, and before we could officially open the doors, they were shut by the Township of New Brunswick. It became apparent a phone call was made attempting to report illegal goings-on in our very legal and very legitimate space, the Content House, to our city's great fire marshal, respectively. After speaking with town officials, not only was this false report a waste of tax dollars, but it was discovered that the Content House required a change of use in accordance with the city's official codes, building codes. That's interesting. This kind of, in the following part, there was a part about we refuse to allow the gatekeepers to continue starving the artists. And then this thing says, became apparent a phone call was made to attempt to report illegal goings-on. Very interesting.
Yeah, I mean, you know, as far as if you were to try and get at the idea of what Chester, Angelique, and Franco meant by the gatekeepers, or, you know, what their story is behind the said phone call, that would really be something that I think that they would have more to say about. I didn't really know, and quite honestly, that was, like, not really my motivation for doing it. It wasn't some sort of, like, fight against anybody kind of a thing. It was, like, I just, like, quite frankly, I told them from the beginning, I was, like, there's a huge piece of self-interest in this for me as well. Because, like, I want a place where I can go and fucking do shows.
Yeah.
You know? That's what it came down for me. And then the idea was, is that, like, you know, like, it's weird because politically I describe myself as an aggressive centralist. Like, I don't really try. I try to really be kind of in the middle of the road about things, and I don't lean two ways. But, like, the idea of, like, a co-op or a collective place where the people involved, you know, not only take, not only get to reap the benefits, but take the responsibility of opening the place up is really what motivated me. And during that campaign, I tagged certain people, and I called out other comedians, and I threatened to give them wedgies if they didn't donate to Jester. Because wow. I thought that was funny. I don't know how well that joke aged. I don't know if I came off as a dick or whatever, but I don't really give a fuck. Like, my whole thing was like, I've seen all these comedians here coming to these open mics, going to these shows, fucking hanging out, using the space. You know what I mean? It's like, why don't you throw $20 in?
Right. You're like Joe Pesci in the movie Casino. You're just the enforcer, you know?
I like to think of myself that way sometimes, even though I'm really not a tough guy.
Hey, where's the fucking money?
My ego likes to pump it up, and I have a great poker face. Like I actually had several like older women that I know in my life, like family friends and stuff, that like thought that I hated them for years because I never smile enough. So now I make a conscious effort to smile more.
Smile at the old ladies. Look, they're locked down in quarantine. They need love too.
But I do it now. Like I went on a walk this morning and I was walking across the bridge and there was some guy there. And it's so fucking weird right now, right? Because like,
yeah,
I'm walking down the sidewalk. Somebody's walking the other direction towards me on the same sidewalk. And I'm like, all right, I'll get off the sidewalk because we're not supposed to be close to each other. But then I don't want people to think that I'm like doing it because they're a leper or something. So I like try and smile and say hello. You know?
Yeah. Be polite during your social distancing. So now this whole Jester thing, I mean, you raised the money, but now I just read an article this morning that New Brunswick City employees, so these housing and yeah, these housing inspectors of New Brunswick are being furloughed for, you know, disaster reasons. I guess there's not a lot of
right.
So even these people that swarmed, that, you know, the fire marshal and all his cronies, they're being furloughed. They're being let off until this COVID situation clears up.
Right, and the reality of the situation is, too, is that, like, you know, we wouldn't be having gatherings at that place at this very moment right now. So it was, like, it was kind of funny timing, right? Because I think you said it was February 19th or something like that.
Yeah.
You know? That's at that time, launched. I would have never thought that less than a month later that the governor of New Jersey would have issued an executive order that banned people from congregating, you know?
Yeah.
But, I mean, that being said, I think that, I think it's going to be cool when all of this is over and all of this gets sorted out, to see people again, and I'm going to be excited to go see people from the stage at Jester. You know?
Bro, I am so missing the group of New Jersey comedy, my New Jersey comedy friends. You know, when you do something 3, 4, 5 times a week, and you know, we do shows together, we smoke weed, we drink beers, and we laugh together, and then that is gone overnight. I mean, I'm still just like going out of my mind because I don't have that outlet anymore, you know?
Right. And this has forced me to become creative with what I do to take up my time. Like this is like a commercial for a fucking hipster joke, but like I started woodworking because I can't go outside. You know what I mean? Like I can't go get on stage. Like, I've been, like, exercising and actually taking care of myself and all this, like, corny shit because I can't go to the fucking mics every night, you know?
What are you building? Birdhouses? Like, how
hipster? Nah, dude, I built a fucking pretty rad platform bed. So I moved in the beginning of February to Bradley Beach, and I built a platform bed that has drawers that are on wheels underneath it, and it has these like sort of nightstand end caps on it, and it was all built with me with like 2 saws and a screw gun and some wood stain, and it's fucking really cool. Actually, it's like a really it's very similar it's a similar sort of like gratification like that I would get from like the first time I bring a bit on stage to the point where like it really starts to work. You know, like, it's like, it wasn't easy the whole time, but it was like this, it was something that was like sort of challenging and uncomfortable, but I was like, I wanted to try it. And then I ended up like liking to do it through the process of like fucking a bunch of stuff up basically.
So when you drove across in the van, did you have to woodwork your van to put a bed in there and some kind of luxuries?
Yeah. So when I bought the van, the guy I bought it from had kind of like started doing that. And then kind of like, basically the guy I bought the van from, when I went to his house to go pick it up, I found it on Craigslist. When I went to his house to go pick it up, he had like 4 of them in the front of his house. And it was like, I guess that was his project. And his wife was like, you need to get rid of one of these fucking things.
Right.
So he had already started, but then I had to modify it like to all of my needs. So I ended up in that van with 4 surfboards, a snowboard, you know, all the clothes that I could need, books and all that stuff. And I had to cut things and build things in order to like find the storage for it. And the other thing that was really cool about it was that at that point I had to really like get rid of all this extra shit that I had, and I haven't missed it, to be honest. Like,
where'd you take your showers on the road? Did you find public restrooms and or in campgrounds? Where'd you shower?
So good question. So I had a makeshift toilet set up in there, but only for number one. So, because you're not going to take a shit in there, you know, that's just, it just doesn't work. But I shit in a lot of Walmarts. I spent a lot of time sleeping in Walmart parking lots because Walmart, and it's actually kind of a smart business plan from them, but like Walmart in most places, unless the municipality prohibits it, which the only places I ran into that were like in places with heavy homeless populations. They didn't want like half the town living in the Walmart parking lot. But they actually have a policy at most Walmarts that you can park your RV there overnight. So I would usually shit in the Walmart, and then I would, like, you know, buy a snack because I felt obligated to buy something because they were letting me stay there overnight. So, like, that was I did that in a lot of places. And then also I would just stay. When you get out west, it's harder to find it around here, but when you get out west, there's tons of BLM land and, like, these federally regulated lands where, like, you don't have to pay to camp, you know? Like, that standoff in Oregon that was pretty famous a few years ago where that cattle rancher's son took over the, you know, the Fish and Wildlife building in, like, Mallhofer or whatever, you know, that was on borough land management land. And when you get into, like, the western half of the country, that shit is everywhere. And also, I got good at shitting outside. And taking a shit outside is, like, it's amazing. And it's the reason that now at home I have, like, I didn't buy a squatty potty, but I have a stool for in front of the toilet. Because when you take a shit, when you're bent at the angles that you have to be in order to squat and actually take a shit, like, it's the best shit you could ever take.
Wow.
Like, I think I really do believe that, like, that whole sales pitch for squatty potty is true, but, like, it's like life-changing. Like, you can take a shit like that, and, like, you barely have to wipe. Because, like, your body's supposed to be like that way when you're taking a shit.
Yeah, if you just walk into, out west, the other piece of information you dropped is if you walk into the fish and game and it's unoccupied, now you're the game warden, you know?
Exactly. Although you have to have guns for that, and I didn't have any firearms in the van.
Just declare yourself on free land the mayor, judge, jury, and executioner.
So it's sort of funny, it's sort of weird, and it's sort of fucked up. But when I bought that van, right, the guy had been doing some work on it, and he actually did this, like, really nice woodworking in the back of it. But it was weird, dude. Like, he had this, like, weird shrine thing set up. There was a mirror on the ceiling. The bed was made in such a way as to where, like, the layout of it was really fucking funky, so it was, like, you couldn't even really fit on it right. It was like a weird, like, metal kid from the 70s wet dream thing going on.
There's a mirror on the ceiling for, like, when he's having sex with lot lizards where he can,
right,
like,
exactly,
see everything.
Exactly. And I did not take the mirror down. I know that's going to be, that might have been the next question. The mirror stayed on the entire time. But, so I got the van, right? And I ended up getting the van, and originally the guy wanted, like, $3,800 for it or something like that, which was actually, like, well below the Blue Book value because it didn't have that many miles when I got it. It was an old ambulance van with the big fiberglass top on top of it. Which
oh,
was
nice.
Plus, yeah, because you could stand up in it straight, which was, like, a game changer if you're going to live in something, like, to just be able to, like, put your pants on while you're standing up straight, or to just stand up straight to not have to be bent over the whole time if you're doing something in the van. So I get the van or whatever, like, I go back the next day and I, like, make him an offer, and he ends up selling me the van for, like, $2,700. It was, like, the deal of a fucking lifetime. And, I actually drove the van, like, right from the DMV to go show it off to my family, and I brought it to my dad's house, and we opened the van up, and I'm showing him about it inside, and he's like, "What is this?" And he points to, like, above the back door of the van. Like, there was this woodworking done above where the rear doors were. And he points to this, and he's like, "What is this?" And I didn't even notice this the whole time I looked in the van. There was a little tin metal swastika glued to the fucking, right above the doors of the van.
Huh.
And I remember saying to the, I remember my dad was like, "Whoa." And I remember saying to the guy, I'm like, "Well, the guy was really nice to me." He's like, "Well, because look at you, you're white."
And I was, yeah.
Holy shit. And then my dad sort of half-heartedly suggested, based upon the part of the country I was going to, that maybe I should just keep that in there in case I wound up with some gnarly white separatist guys in Idaho somewhere, like, by mistake. I could be like, "Oh, I'm down with the cause," but I took it out, obviously.
Or you could make it Velcro, so if you're, you know, most of the time you have it off, but in an emergency you could put that on and claim allegiance, you know.
Yeah, right.
Or if there's, like, some really hot, like, you know, German neo-Nazi type bitch, you know, and you want to show her the mirror on the ceiling, you know what I'm saying? You can just be like, pop that on real quick.
But yeah, it would, I mean, there's some, like, you hear about that shit. Like, I remember, I actually, my uncles live, one of them has since passed since I was there, but they live on the top of this hill in Montana. Pretty far, it's pretty close to I-94, but it's pretty far from anything else. Kind of this old, like, little, I don't know what you call it, like an outpost or whatever. And I went and stopped there, spent the night with them. My uncle loaded me up with a bunch of elk, which was, like, so delicious that I would eat along the way.
Nice.
It was a little cooler. It was so good. And, like, he had caught it and got it butchered, and they would go hunting out there. And so we leave. I'm with my sister. My sister is, like, my sister's young, and she's, you know, into music and shit. Like, she's a vegetarian, you know what I mean? She's checking all these, like these boxes. And so we're in Montana, and we're leaving, and in order to get back to the highway from there, we're like, oh, let's go kind of, like, try and check shit out. So, like, the whole time that we were driving, like, basically when I left New Jersey, I was, like, I left New Jersey on, like, the 3rd or 4th of September, and I had class on the 22nd, and I was, like, whenever I get there, you know? So I didn't have, like, everything all mapped out. And we ended up driving through this little town and stopping to grab breakfast in Montana. And it turned out that we were in Lincoln, which is the town where Ted Kaczynski mailed all of his bombs from.
Whoa.
Yeah, and we ate some really good country breakfast, like, literally across the street from the post office where he had sent all of his bombs out.
There was a little swastika on the top of the post office. That's how you know you're in a small town.
Well, there was two people in there that were eating. It looked like a father and son, or maybe like a son-in-law and a father, or I don't know. And they were both wearing camo because I guess they were getting ready to go hunt. And the one kid was, like, literally the biggest, like, corn-fed American. Like, it was the kind of dude that, like, they would use if they wanted to do propaganda. Like, the guy was, like, 6'4", jacked. Head to toe in camo with face paint on, eating pancakes at this place. You know?
He, like, chokes out the elk, like, with his bare hands.
Yeah. He hunts elk without weapons. Yeah.
Just boxes its face up. I got another one, Pops. All right, Mongo. So this, what else I want to ask you, one of the times, and we're, well, you know what, let's keep going with this. So when did you make it to college? Classes started September 27, or what did you say, 24?
I think it was the 22nd. And so I got to the town that I was going to stay in Corvallis. I got there the 20th or 21st, maybe.
You just made it.
Yeah, I mean, I knew I was gonna. Like, I have some old friends from the first time I lived in Oregon, and they all live in the Portland metro area, so I spent a couple days hanging out with them up there. And then, like, I had class started on a Monday, and I think I got to Corvallis on the Saturday before it started, maybe.
Nice. And then how long were you in the van before you went in the dorm rooms?
Oh, I never went in the dorm rooms. I stayed in the van the entire time.
And where'd you shower in college?
So I went to the gym every morning.
Smart.
Yeah. Yeah, and it was good. It was actually one, it was funny because the gym membership, I hesitate to say that it was free because tuition is really fucking expensive, especially now. But I didn't have to pay extra to go to the gym. And I started going to the gym with the idea of just showering, and then I actually got self-conscious about people thinking that, like, this is where I shower, so I should go here and work out, and I started working out every day. So I got in, like, the best shape of my life. I would wake up and go to the gym for, like, 90 minutes. I would, like, like, nothing crazy. I would get on, like, the elliptical for a little bit. I'd, like, lift some light weights, and then I would, like, usually get on, like, a rowing machine for the last 20 minutes. And then I would take a shower around, like, 7:30. I would go grab, like, coffee and a breakfast burrito, and then I would go to class at 9 o'clock.
Nice. Yeah, it's funny. I was in, when I went to the University of New Orleans, and then afterward I went to L.A. for a year, And I was living in the back of an office, and I was, but next door was the LA Fitness. So I would wake up, I go sneak out, avoid the guard of the building, go to the LA Fitness, and then like be all dressed up nice, and then come back like and make believe that I was just arrived to the office for the day, you know?
Right.
And right. If I was still there during this quarantine, I would have been screwed because the fucking gym's closed.
Yeah, it's funny, man. Like, I actually, it sounds crazy, but, like, I feel really grateful that I got to spend that time in the van because I'm not sure if it's ever going to work out in my life again that I have a year with minimal responsibilities that I can just kind of live, you know, live as I go like that.
Yeah.
But I'll tell you what, man, I'm real, real happy that I'm not living in that van right now because it would suck. Because my whole, like, everything was based upon the usage of, like, public places, you know?
Absolutely.
Because it was cool. I didn't spend a lot of time in there. Like, I would hang out in there and, like, watch shit on my phone or whatever. I had a little TV, but I actually never really ended up using it just because I didn't set up my power inverter the right way and it would, like, kill my battery. But, like, I would hang out in the van before I went to bed, but I wasn't spending time in there. So it was like the entire day I would be, you know, quote, out of the house. And so I would hang out, like, I would obviously study at the library at school. Or then, like, if I was going to, you know, I would go hang out at a coffee shop or I would sit in a park if it was nice out. And it was like, it was a very deliberate way to live. I'll put it to you that way. Like, everything that I did, like, was not even necessary, like, was calculated in some sense, you know?
Yeah,
like, absolutely. There was no just, like, waking up and being like, oh, what am I going to do today, you know?
Yeah, well, class puts you in line because you have to deliver homework, you have to study for tests, and so it's like, okay, Right. Let me work out, I got to study for the test, I got to go here. You just have to.
And part of my degree requirements was to do a senior thesis, and that was really intensive, but I got really lucky. My department had a great computational lab, and that became not only where I worked on my project, but it also, like, I would go there, you know, I would go there in the evening typically, or between classes if I had time, and I would go and I would work on my project, and I would work for an hour, and then for 10, 15 minutes, I would, like, dick around on YouTube. And then I would go get a cup of coffee, and I'd come back, and I'd work for an hour. And it was like, I can't tell you, you know, my department was pretty small. There was probably only, you know, I think that in my graduating class for my department, I mean, I went to a big school. I went to Oregon State. It's like 20,000 kids. But the physics department probably only had 20 to 25 kids that were, like, seniors on any given year. And I rarely saw another soul in that computer lab. Like, 9 out of 10 times that I would be in there, it would just be me in there. You know? Yeah. Because everybody else would have laptops or whatever at home. You know? And I would just be enjoying my time in that lab working on my thesis. And then it was like, it even changed the way that I consumed, like, media and stuff, because it was, like, a deliberate thing for me to, like, put something on.
I mean, the good thing about doing homework in the library is you can't masturbate, you know?
Exactly.
It would be really awkward if you were caught masturbating in the library. So then it becomes, okay, now you actually have to do your essay. You actually have to do it.
Right. And the first time I was at Oregon State, I dated a girl who was into having sex in risky places. And we used to sneak off into the handicapped bathrooms in the basement of Oregon State and have encounters. But the fun part about it was that since they were handicapped bathrooms, they would lock by a motion sensor. So if you didn't, like, move in front of the motion sensor enough, the door would just be unlocked. But there was a famous porn star for a while that got her start because there was a video of her masturbating in the Oregon State Public Library. And she wasn't even a student there. She was just some girl from Oregon that lived close by.
hey, she's using the public facilities. You know, I think that's a real hero story, you know?
Yeah, absolutely.
Rags to riches.
I think she's retired now. I was never really a big fan of her work, but I knew who she was because she was like the Oregon State girl, you know?
That's great. Not even go, she doesn't even pay tuition. She just leaves a sloppy trail wherever she goes.
They actually had a thing, so that part of the country, and I would love to tell you that I was educated as to the reasons why and all that kind of shit, but it is not just conjecture, it is reality. There is just tons and tons and tons of homeless people in the Pacific Northwest. Tons of them. Like, they're everywhere. The town Corvallis that I lived in was a town of, during the school year, had 50,000 people, and then the rest of the year had 20,000. And it was 10 miles off the highway, and there was nothing around it. It was like an isolated little town in the middle of fucking nowhere. And you got these guys show up. It was like the beginning of First Blood, you know, like there was just waves of these homeless people that ended up there. And they actually had a policy at Oregon State Library. Like, it was open 24 hours a day, like most of the time, but you had to have a student ID between the hours of like 12 and 6, because you would go in there and there'd just be homeless people getting out of the rain.
Yeah.
Like all over the place. You know, and they're pretty liberal out there and tolerant, so they weren't going to tell anybody to leave except if it was between the hours of 12 and 6.
Yeah, that's interesting.
Interesting culture out there, man.
So with this quarantine, you know, it's sort of poking some holes in American exceptionalism. You know, without free healthcare and people get coronavirus, you know, it's really shows how much America sucks. Everyone's getting laid off at the same time that they're right. Getting kicked off of their private insurance, that there's a pandemic. But then they're like, oh, well, if you have COVID, we'll take care of you for free. But if you don't, then it's like, what's the difference between cancer and the, and I don't know. I just,
I agree with you. And like I said, I'm a pretty middle of the road guy, but, I mean, it has exposed, you know, the inconsistencies, and sort of like it's like kind of popped the bubble on a lot of things in this country, you know.
Yeah, we'll see. Like people, yeah, when we can gather again, I wonder if things will be different, like financially, if we'll get like free healthcare or a universal basic income or a debt jubilee for at least student loans. You know, I wonder if things will shake up.
Well, you know, this was my thing. This whole relief package that they just passed, right? Somewhere, like, I think sum total, it was like a $2 trillion cash injection into the economy, right? Which can cause all these problems with inflation. And then if you factor in the Federal Reserve's, this is a crazy thing that nobody seems to talk about, is that the Federal Reserve basically told the holders of any bonds or mortgage-backed securities, which is a whole nother, you know, relapse of 2008, that they would buy them back, no questions asked, which was somewhere around the equivalent of $4 to $5 trillion that are being injected back into the economy. Now, if they had just canceled student loan debt, which I think is somewhere slightly north of $2 trillion right now, that wouldn't have added any more cash, which would have stemmed inflation, like it would have put a kibosh on it, and it would have had disposable income for, you know, millions and millions of Americans would have shot up by something, you know, on average around $300 to $400 a month forever, not just the $1,200 check, you know? So I think that the problem when they did Obamacare the first time was that they compromised, you know, the Affordable Care Act. I think they compromised on what the penalties were because the penalties were not significant enough to force healthy people into the insurance pool, right? It was $300 the first year, $600 the second year, and it capped out at $700. Meanwhile, insurance premiums, you know, for healthy young individuals around that time were somewhere around like $180 a month. So, like, from a cost benefit analysis, if you're a young kid and you don't think there's anything wrong with you, am I going to pay $300 or am I going to pay $1,500? Like, I'm going to pay $300, you know?
Yeah.
And that also ties into the fact that for most people, it was money that they kind of wrote off anyway, because it's money they get with their tax returns, which is sort of another load of shit to me, because basically on some level, I don't want a tax return, because essentially what that means is that I gave the government a loan for a year with no interest. Now, if I owe the IRS money, they're tacking on interest every step of the way, you know. But I think that student loan forgiveness would be the single most important thing economically that they could do in this country, because it would inject trillions of dollars back into people's pockets. I saw an interesting thing. It was actually from a rapper that I follow, but he said, fuck $1,200, give everybody 120 points on their credit score.
That's interesting. You know? Yeah, but then the only advantage to that is you can borrow money and then get charged interest. And
True.
But I also am so mad that everyone in this pandemic is listening to Bill Gates. I want to say a few things about Bill Gates. Number one, he became the richest man on the planet because he didn't pay his employees enough. That's how you become the richest person on the planet. When your employees make you money and your business successful, you say, oh, thank you, that's all mine, and fuck you, because you're a hoarding cunt, not because you're a super person. The second thing is, Bill Gates went to Jeffrey Epstein's pedophile island and flew on the Lolita Express multiple times. Jeffrey Epstein's killed by the billionaire class, and then Bill Gates is now telling everybody what to do in this pandemic. Bill Gates is on trial in Indonesia for testing vaccines on children without their consent. So this is a guy who talks about viruses all the time and talks about overpopulation all the time and really looks at, you know, poor people like the dirty, filthy peasants that should get off his lawn. And now we're listening to this guy. It's like, wait, why were you on Pedophile Island, though, with Jeffrey Epstein, though? So shouldn't he go in, like, a wood chipper? Like, fuck this guy, you know? And people are holding him up.
I personally think my favorite take on this whole thing, there's a reason that I find it, and I'm an Occam's razor kind of guy. Like, I usually think that the simplest answer is the correct one, right? And I think that's what that means. I don't know if I'm using that term wrong. But, you know, if this was some genetically engineered viral weapon sent to decimate the world, I would be curious as to why it's only killing people that are going to die in the next fucking 10 years anyway with any significant numbers, you know?
Yeah, you know, you can put it in a computer, mass death on a grid, but, you know, maybe biodiversity of the human population is a little different than what your computer can calculate, you know?
Yeah, that's true. I mean, I think that, you know, I don't know, I think the reason that, you know, on a more sort of 30,000 feet up kind of thing, I think the reason that people in general listen to anyone from a point of authority, whether it's Bill Gates or President Trump or Barack Obama or whoever it is, you know, or Bernie Sanders or like, you know, go across all the political spectrums and all the personality spectrums. I think the reason that people, you know, place weight behind what those folks say is that they're afraid on some level, right? And I think that they're scared, and I think that they're looking, you know, to this idea. And I think that it's also, the idea that this is some sort of man-created thing, like, on some level, implicitly lends it to the idea that if we can only figure out who started this and what they used, then we can just shut it off, right? And for me, the actual reality is sort of much more terrifying, is that this is just fucking, you know, this is just a natural part of the Earth's life cycle, you know. I read something the other day, and I don't understand the methodology and all that behind it, but, like, you know, I read something from a social anthropologist or a medical anthropologist or whatever their fucking title is, but somebody that studies like culture over the lifespan of humanity. And, you know, several people had made what appeared to me from a scientific standpoint to be credible arguments that one out of every six people that's ever been born on this planet has died of tuberculosis, you know, across the history of the planet. So, like, I think that this is just, like, I think this is just the fucking, you know, this is some new shit. This is some new shit that's killing a lot of people. I think that this is just something that happens throughout humanity. Now, the other side of it is like, I am totally on board with the idea that authoritarian and nefarious figures are going to leverage this to their advantage, you know?
Right.
It's the same argument when people talked about, right, it's like September 11th, right? Like, people always thought that, like, Bush and the neocons planned September 11th, and I never really bought into that for various reasons, but what I did see as being obvious was that they capitalized upon it to get what they wanted to get done anyway. And that kind of comes from me, like, you know, like, I have a hard time sometimes with some of these things because I just, like, I just don't think that people are smart enough to do shit like this. Like, I really don't. Like, I don't think that there's enough coordination amongst really smart people to pull shit like this off. Like, I think it's just, I kind of think shit happens, but I do think that there's people that are waiting in the wings to fucking, you know, figure out a way to curtail our rights over this, you know? And it's an interesting thing for me watching the stuff that's going on in these state capitals across the country, you know, where people are protesting these stay-at-home orders. And it's like, it's crazy because part of me, as somebody that knows healthcare workers, right? Like, my mom was a respiratory therapist for fucking 30 years at Jersey Shore in Neptune City. And she still has friends that work there. I have friends that work in those places. And, you know, like, wherever this virus came from, like, it's fucking devastating those people. Like, those people, the healthcare workers, are getting their asses kicked by this thing, right? And then you have these people that show up and they say, well, you know, it doesn't matter. You can't curtail our ingrained First Amendment right to assemble. And I'm like, I can see both sides of it. You know what I mean? Like, I can understand the arguments from both sides of it. And I am always cautiously optimistic that, you know, this country isn't going to slide into civil war and authoritarianism. But I think that, like, if it's going to happen in my lifetime, it's going to happen as a result of what's going on right now.
Yeah, you know, it's like, did they let 9/11 happen or did they plan for it? Did they, and then, right, like, reap the benefits? Right. And then the other thing is, did Bill Gates fund Charles Lieber to send coronavirus to Wuhan? Did Charles Lieber, the chair of the Harvard chemistry department, who was recently arrested by the FBI, did he do it? Or was this just a natural thing that he had some shady Chinese business dealings and it looks like he planned it? And then what the government's reaction to it is to grab more power, this and that, use it as an opportunity. But, you know, if you look at just what Jester, if you look at Jester as a microcosm, like, was it what the fire marshal that closed Jester, was that because the ordinances, the building code was wrong, or was that because of collusion because of a competing business who felt threatened by the Jester community business model, made a phone call to the city of New Brunswick after spending $1.5 million to start an A-level comedy club? Did they have gained some people inside the government that they can squash their competition with? What do you think?
I mean, you know, I don't know.
Is it a conspiracy?
Yeah. I don't think
or
so.
Or did they seize an opportunity that was presented to them by the fire marshal?
Possibly. It's also, you know, the other thing that's possible too is that was a building that had residential tenants in it and a business downstairs, and maybe they were the people that were pissed off, you know, or maybe there was somebody that fucking, maybe there was somebody that felt shunned by the place that wanted to be a dick, you know. I don't know.
Like the displaced yogi?
Yeah, right. Yeah, right. Exactly. Maybe that guy.
maybe that guy went all like Wild Wild Country in his own way and figured he would put some salmonella in the salad bar. You know, I don't know.
Maybe he drove to New Brunswick from Oregon in a van.
He might have. You might be onto something.
And then he sold the van for $2,700, had to liquidate it to start the yoga place, you know what I mean? Lose his clients, you know. And then he put derivative financial swaps in a bad repo market. You know, his financial assets, boom, it comes crashing down after a brief spike. Bop, now he's got to sell it to Jester. Now Jester, you know what I mean?
It's a tangled web. Anything is possible at that level, you know. Anything is possible. But, I mean, you know, the reality of it is that, like, there is no competition really for Jester, because I've never run across somebody who was trying to do what Jester's done. I mean, maybe on a less organized, smaller level, right? Like, you have these open mics at places and stuff that people run, and it becomes a place for people to come hang out and all that kind of stuff. But as far as like a, you know, a place where people can develop, you know, sort of organically or otherwise, like, there's nowhere. I don't know. Maybe there's other places in the country, but I'm not aware of them. Right? Like, it's not a their business model, quote unquote, is not really a business. Like, you know,
it's a community,
right? Because the thing is, this is what I learned. What I learned from doing that business plan thing, and which kind of had been like implicitly apparent to me, but basically comedy clubs are places where you can charge a cover for people to pay extra for overpriced.
Right.
So on some level, right, like, I don't are making money off of ticket sales necessarily with any real thing. I mean, that's like, there's a comedy club down by me that's BYO. I don't know how they stay in business, but then I went there to go see a comedian a couple months ago. And the way they stay in business is they have a 2-item food minimum and they have $10 cannoli. You know what I mean?
Right.
So that's a totally different. And there's, you could argue about the merits of this, that, and the third of those things. It's a totally different business plan than, you know, Jester, which Jester is just supposed to be a place for people like me or you or anyone else that wants to get on stage and have fun and try and develop their craft to go, you know? I mean, as far as I know, like, there's no, I don't know. I spoke with the folks at Jester yesterday, and there is no beef to speak of. You know?
Yeah.
Between the comedy club that shall not be named. You know what I'm saying? But there's like, the air is clear there, at least now. You know? So, I mean, it also comes down to the whole fucking game of telephone, man.
Right. Know? Yeah, I don't know. Maybe I'm just looking for conspiracies where there isn't any. But anyway,
well, it's fun to connect those dots. You know. Hello.
Am I on the line with Sean and Franco?
You are.
You.
Hey, Franco, what's up, buddy? We were just did a whole podcast for an hour long about Jester Comedy Company LLC. How you doing, bud?
Good.
So, what has been going on? Have you been getting the business plans and updating your building codes during the pandemic, or what's going on? I just read an article, by the way, that the New Brunswick city employees have been furloughed, so they're getting laid off right now for the what's going on with Jester?
So right after Angelique and I brought in the all the permits, thanks to Sean and the GoFundMe and everything like that, we were able to, you know, get all the money popping so we can just, you know, start making moves on all the paperwork. They said that we have to wait 20 days for to get any feedback, right? And after that, within those 20 days, this happened. The whole epidemic thing became like serious, and it became everyone was like quarantine shit. We got a call one day from the plumbing inspector, and he just asked a couple questions. Contact, because we just assumed, you know, a lot of these people are going to have to be working from home. We're not going to have those people at their offices and stuff. You know, and if let's say these guys are home, they don't really have everybody's file. I don't think they can just take those things home and just keep it at home and wait till someone calls in and stuff like that. So we've been kind of waiting. We're trying to figure out if we can make moves while everything is going on. Because ideally, we'd love to open up. At the same time, everybody else is opening up. So.
Yeah, that sounds tough.
Yeah.
So they said 20 days, and then how many days ago did they say 20 days?
Oh, this was in March. This was in March. Early March we went in, I think. Or late February, I can't remember.
Okay, so now March. It's yeah. April 18 today.
Yeah.
Well, March 14th was when Murphy ordered all non-essential stuff to be shut down, so they probably... I have a friend that works in a county office, and he's considered an essential worker, but like half of the people there that aren't essential got furloughed pretty quickly, too.
Yeah.
And he's working from home. But I mean, he works for the public defender's office, so people are still getting put in jail. They still need lawyers and shit. So,
damn,
that's an essential business, a prison industrial. But
yeah,
Can I ask you this question directly, Franco? Now, I posed this to Sean. He wasn't sure. This comes from the GoFundMe. The problem that. Jester ran into, and I want to read, I think these are your words. It became very apparent a phone call was made attempting to report illegal goings on in our very legal and very legitimate space, the Content House, to our city's great fire marshal, respectively. So, do you know who made a phone call to the fire marshal to start the ball rolling on your...
We don't have... like solid proof. We don't have a name, but we have. I mean, it could have been a lot of people. You know, it could have been anybody. Really, it could have been the fucking people that lived all the way upstairs and shit like that.
Mm.
Could have been the restaurant owner. We don't know, because it happened after a festival where we went, you know, all day long from like 11:30 in the afternoon all the way up to fucking almost 1 o'clock at night. So it could have been a whole lot of people. Some people that might not want comedy in the city, or want comedy upstairs from their fucking restaurant, or downstairs from where they sleep. So
interesting. So you guys are on the second floor in downtown New Brunswick, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so it was zoned as a yoga studio.
That's what it was before. So, yeah, it was zoned as a yoga studio.
And then, what's the difference between a content house and a yoga studio? I mean, you know, if you rent an office and it's insurance, or if it's mortgages, I mean, I don't see why an architect would have to make those changes.
Yeah, dude, it's like, for us, like, people who don't fucking know the whole architect, all the paperwork bullshit. Honestly, the only difference between a yoga studio and a place where they do stand-up comedy is chairs. That's literally the only difference, bro. Chairs and a microphone. That's it. Because it's just big old space, more chairs, and a microphone. And some speakers. That's it. But we'd have to go through the town and say, we're going to have 50 chairs or some shit like that, you know? And then... they have to, you know, write that down and be like, okay, they're going to have 50 chairs. Where are those chairs going to be? Which direction are they going to face? Oh, you need a theater license. You need this. You need that. You need this. Just to have that change. Oh, it's no longer a yoga studio. Okay, now you need a fucking you need a mop sink. You need a sink. You need different water things. You need water for people and shit like that. You need whatever, more exit signs, more this, more that, more that. And I'm like, well, okay, all right. So that's pretty much it.
So do you have to take classes to get a theater license then?
No. It's just, you just gotta apply for one. Apply for a permit and get a license. And, yeah.
Oh, boy.
It's just a way for the town to make money.
Yeah, dude.
I mean, it's the same thing like when they have speed traps and shit. Like I was in a neighborhood the other day for work, and it said they had a big sign that said 25 miles an hour, aggressively patrolled by unmarked police cars. And it's like, if they were really concerned about the safety of the residents and didn't want people to drive more than 25 miles an hour, they would put a marked police car there to let you know that you're violating the law. They would rather catch you speeding and give you a ticket. Mm-hmm. You know? It's the same shit with all those local building inspectors. And it's really bad in New Jersey because there's whole economies built around, like, those people's jobs, right? Like, if your job is to find problems with things, you're going to find problems everywhere.
Yeah.
I have it on very good information. I heard this from a police officer himself, that Hoboken has been devastated because there aren't any people drinking and driving anymore. And so, yeah. So because Uber and Lyft have come in, and now the drunk driving has gone to almost zero. And that's, you know, $10,000 per person they catch drunk driving. So they've been ordered, the police officers of Hoboken have been ordered to pull over Uber and Lyft drivers for any reason possible. If their lights are off, and basically harass them. If they go over the speed limit by a mile an hour. If they roll through a stop sign instead of stopping, pull them over, harass them, give them tickets. You know, and it says protect and serve the community. And you would think that less drunk driving is good for Hoboken. But it's the cops are not happy about that.
Same, dude.
Isn't that same fucking crazy?
It's the same shit with permits, dude.
Dude, you know you need a permit to put a sign in the window?
Doesn't surprise me.
Like, I can't... we can't advertise our spot outside unless we have a fucking permit for it.
And that's not tied into the theater permit?
No. No. They would never tie that into anything. They need to make their money on the sign you're going to put up in the front.
Oh, my God.
You know what I mean?
So how much is that per year to advertise a sign?
Oh, we haven't even looked into that. We're like, that's the least of our worries.
Right.
They're like, we're like, fuck that, bro. We can just Instagram it for a while, and then we figure out, you know, we'll figure that out. I don't want to fucking pay for a sign. Imagine if we paid for a sign and it's still up right now, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, we'd be so pissed. we've been waiting for a fucking year, bro. More than a year. Yeah, it's been a year since we first got the spot. We've been paying rent for like a year. So it's like fucking,
yeah.
Can't do anything with it.
And then it's like you got to pay rent, and then you got to pay New Brunswick to have a sign, then you got to pay New Brunswick to have a theater thing, and their great expertise is that you need a slop sink. And then in all their infinite wisdom, they say, oh, you got to pay me for the sign that you bought.
Yeah. It's ridiculous. It's absolutely insane. Well, whatever.
Have you...
I always joke about this kind of shit, but this is the kind of stuff that turns liberals into conservatives, dude.
Yeah, dude.
Like, for real.
You know what the shitty part is, too? The guy that owns the restaurant downstairs, like, he every once in a while, like, poke his head upstairs, and he talks to the landlord about, he wants to make that second floor a bar for his restaurant and shit. So it's like, he's cool, but he's kind of like, these motherfuckers. You know what I mean?
Right.
He wants to make it a bar, but we're turning it into that. But, so, I guess he's just waiting for us to fucking fail or something. But also, the landlord's like, this guy's been saying that for years, so.
Yeah, but it's like now probably, you know, he's only doing takeout orders and he's probably slowing his business down too, you know, so.
Yeah, well, I hope it does well, dude. I really hope it does well because that ramen spot downstairs is popping, dude. It is popping.
Yeah. It's like, why can't y'all work together? You could probably have shows and then have them as like your, the food service during the show or something.
That'd be awesome. That'd be awesome.
You're more about a community working together when I read the mission statement of Jester Comedy Company, LLC.
Yeah. Yeah, me and Angie, like, we're all about that shit, dude. Improv, fucking... That's how her and I met, you know? And that's kind of like the... That's like my first experience with comedy is working together, you know? It's improv, it's, you know? So, it's like, that just stuck with me. Things are a lot cooler, bro. Things are way cooler when everybody works together, I think.
Yeah. Now, when you started doing stand-up, did you feel like, oh, why am I hogging all this spotlight?
Nah. Not at all.
Yeah.
I did notice, though, how clicky it was at the beginning. It's not as clicky now. It's a big old fucking family now, but it was very clicky when I first started.
Yeah, I don't know. I think New Jersey kind of settled into a good community. I really do.
Yeah.
Since I've been here, you know, when I see my friends, you know, we shake hands, we hug, we drink together, we laugh together, you know, we smoke weed together. I love it. I love the New Jersey comedy scene.
Yeah.
And I miss it so terribly in this quarantine.
Yeah. Dude, I posted something about on Facebook about how much, like, I miss stand-up, but I also miss watching comics bomb. Yeah. And I am so honest about that.
It's fun.
That shit is so fun. Because I've been, like, there's nothing better than being the kids in the back of the class, you know? Like, you're just sitting back there, and you want someone up there eating it, and you're like, oh. This is cringy, and it's juicy, bro. And I love it. And, like, and there's something about the feeling, too, like, if it's a shit room, and, like, I think the first time I flipped the switch was when I was with Sean. We did that show in, what was it, Jersey City?
Yeah, dude.
It was Jersey City, right? It was, like, for this, I don't even know, it was for teachers or something?
It was like a benefit for Jersey City teachers, yeah, that was fucked, that was rough for me.
Dude, it was the first time where, like, it's the first time, like, I was so afraid because I was like, I'm going to bomb. There is no way they set us up for success here. Like, this is a bomb ready to happen. So I'm sitting there, and I was getting nervous, and then I got so nervous that I was just like, okay, flip the switch. And it was just like, let's take this L, baby. Let's take this L. And I remember dabbing you up, Sean, and being like, let's fucking take this L, baby. Let's just go for it, bro. Why not? I went up there, ate it, and then fucking Sean. They put Sean up after a fucking poet. And he was really good. He was really funny. No, wait, were you after the poet or the singer?
I think I was after the poet. Yeah. Oh my yeah, because I think you went after the singer. Yeah.
Oh, I did go after a singer. Oh, my
God. Yeah, and the host was wild because he obviously, like, knew everybody involved. And he was kind of, like, not even going to lie, he was kind of killing it, hosting, you know?
Yeah.
And I don't know, dude, he brought me up and he's like, this white boy isn't like a white boy from downtown Jersey City or something. Like, whatever it was that he said, I was like, okay.
Yeah.
Like, I don't know what I'm supposed to do with that.
Dude, he was, what's it called? He knew everybody, but he didn't know how to host. But he still killed, and it's hard to explain. It's hard for you to imagine that if you don't know what that is, you know? Like, it's just a local celebrity that doesn't know all the proper skills in hosting. Because then he was just like, all right, I'm going to bring my main up for some comedy. All right. And, like, it wasn't, like, ladies and gentlemen, Franco Danger. It was, I'm going to bring my main up for some comedy, all right? It's my main right here for some comedy. Give it up.
Right, right.
That's it. And I was supposed to walk on stage. It was just like, oh, okay, I didn't know that.
Yeah.
Oh, it's just like,
So what do you mean by a switch got turned in your head? What switch was that night?
It was like, it was out of, like, pure, we can't get lower than here. You know? Like, if you know you're going to lose and there's no way out of this, it's like, okay, it's kind of like I broke, you know?
Yeah.
One time, long story short, one time I was so paranoid in the backseat of my friend's car, so I was finished smoking, so paranoid, and he kept fucking with me, and I was like, freaking out, because I was like, they know, everybody knows, we're driving crazy, you know, the people see us, and blah, 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 and it was just, like, so much, like, fear in my heart, in my head, and I'm freaking out. Then, long story short, this guy hits a cop car on 22, and then, but we don't know it's a cop car, so we kind of pull over, right? And then we got in the car accident. We're like, oh, my God, it's, you know, it's like, holy shit. We hit a car. We're terrified. And I look back, and then I see the fucking lights. It was an undercover. And the moment I saw the lights, I just started laughing. I started laughing so hard. I was like, we're so fucked. And that was right. The same switch. That was the same switch. It was just like, oh, my God. I was like, we're so fucked. So this guy singing before me, oh, I'm fucked. And then I just started laughing, and I was like, fuck it, let's take this out. So, like, yeah. You can do. You know, you can't do nothing.
So that gives you a kind of, like, confidence when the fear is gone, where it's like we've already faced death.
Yeah.
Can't give it twice. I remember I was going to go up on stage, and I had all this material about slam poetry that I was doing, and I was like, that was what I wanted to open with, and the dude before me absolutely, like, actually shut it down. And I was like, they're not going to respect me if I fucking talk about this. It was terrible. It was terrible.
Why are you going to shit on his art with your art? Don't shit on his art with your art.
The best part was when we left, we're outside, and some dude goes to Franco, yo, good job. And I thought he was talking to both of us. And I was like, yo, thanks, man. He's like, oh, I was talking to him, but...
No, I'm definitely not talking about your performance. Trust me.
And then, dude, after that was that Staten Island where we went?
Yeah.
With the fucking Russian bikers at the pool table?
They're eating sausage and shit?
Yeah, that was pure insanity.
Dude, that night was crazy. That night, I forgot how crazy that night was, bro. That was another just bomb city, bro. It was one table. We were performing for one table filled with Russian bikers. And... Dude, the fucking, what's his name? Oh my God, I love him. What's his name? Who hosted?
Oh, he's got a brother, right?
Nick Cara. It was Nick Cara who hosted. Greg and Rob were supposed to host, but they didn't, so Nick Cara hosted it. Hilarious. I love Nick, bro. I love him. But there was a point where he almost got fucking rocked. He was crossing some lines to those Russian bikers, and I was like, yo, I'm sitting there like, yo, bro, what the fuck? But he's on stage, and he's like, what's that, your little gang name? And I'm like, dude, don't say that. What is this guy doing? Fuck, he didn't give a shit. And then, dude, they didn't do a fuck either. A comic would be up there, they would be talking through it, and then if one decided they were going to have a cigarette, the whole table decided that they were going to have a cigarette.
Like, so in the venue, or they left?
They all would leave. The only people that are next, the only people that are in the room are the ones that are next.
Right.
That's it.
So the only thing that prevented him from getting rocked was the pool table.
Oh, yeah.
Like, if that guy didn't have to get up and walk 10 feet to go around the circumference of the pool table, he would have just, like, stood up and punched him in the face for sure.
Right. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. That's good. As a comic, you gotta use your environment. You gotta, you know, stay behind the grand piano. Well, cool, man. I just wanted to, you know, do this feel-good story about Jester meeting their funding requirement.
Yeah, we got it. That shit was, it was so awesome. Yeah, again, thank you so much, Sean. That was really awesome. Dude, and the funny thing was me and Angelique were arguing about, like, should we do a GoFundMe? Not even arguing. We're just talking. Like, should we do one? No, we shouldn't. No, we should. Like, it's like begging. We're like, no, we shouldn't do it. And I'm like, we should. And then we were in the middle of working up a bio to get ready because we're slowly, like, inching our way over. And then all of a sudden, Sean's like, gotcha, bitch. And just put that shit up.
Yeah, nice.
But dude, the whole thing was, I remember seeing, like, I forget where it was, but you guys were like throwing a show somewhere, and it was like free show, but donations welcome. All donations go to the Jester. Like, it was somewhere, like,
yeah,
it was a bar show somewhere.
Yeah.
And I just remember, dude, honestly, there was like a couple of levels of motivation for me. But the first thing was I thought of all the comics that came there that were there every fucking week for that open mic and everyone that did the festival. And I was like, if these cocksuckers all put $20 down, they would have all the money that they needed. You know?
Yeah.
And then I was also like, dude, like, it's a free show, but you can donate if you want. And I was like, and I get it, like, from your perspective, like, it's hard to, like, ask. And I was like, but if I do it, it wouldn't, like, it's fine.
You know, and that's what incentivized me to make a donation when it's like, you know, I've had a GoFundMe when I was doing my stand-up special. At first, I tried to raise the money from a GoFundMe, and I missed my goal. But for Sean to do it on behalf of Franco, I was like, you know what? This guy is just trying to pull up his friend in the community. You know what? Who am I to...
But, and it was all all because Angelique started that Instagram account, Brian St. John's mustache. It all comes back to that.
Yeah.
That's where the whole journey started.
Bro,
the
that's whole community. Started, like, and then you just start talking shit online to each other, and then you're best friends.
It was like this time a year ago. Yeah. Roughly. Maybe a little bit before that or whatever, but it was the whole thing. And I would just have so much fun ripping on St. John's mustache. Because in my mind, I'm the mustache king of the Jersey Shore comics, you know, so.
No, that's cool.
That, like, illustrates the whole thing, too. Like, Eric, like, we were talking, like, the gatekeepers. Like, with the internet, dude, the gatekeepers now are Instagram and YouTube and fucking Twitter and whoever else. Like, if they ban you, like, that's where the power lies. Because you don't need fucking anybody else to have a career now.
Yeah.
You really don't.
Yeah, that's true.
Like, I got lucky, dude. I recorded some shit in Oregon, and then I recorded shit in Jester, and, like, it cost $400. And it came out great.
Yeah. You know? Yeah, yeah.
Like, that's the great content, whatever. You know what I mean? But the production quality is as good as anything else.
Yeah. It's really good.
And now I'm at the point, like, I was telling Franco this, but I was, you know, Eric, I recorded a half hour in Oregon that I'm never really happy with it, but I'm like, it's good enough to put out, I guess, as an album. But we were talking about Linux before. I actually just downloaded Blender because I want to make cartoons for it. Ooh, and do cool. A little cartoon special, mm-hmm. You know, so. But I don't need anybody to tell me I can do that. Like, I don't need an agent or nothing or a fucking booker or anybody that. Like, I just needed to go fucking to a comedy club that liked me and let me do that there, you know? Mm-hmm. Or Jester, which let me do it there, like, just on the strength. Which was, that was the whole thing. It was like, you got, like, there's no opportunities for people like you guys are putting out there. It's fucking awesome.
Yeah. Yeah, and that's why we're doing it, man. I, you know, it'd be a dream to have, like, you know, just, like, a whole mob of us dropping albums, you know, getting our own, like, little ecosystem of just comedy. You know, the people that are ready to drop their hours and record that shit, boom, we could do it at our spot. We could do it, you know. We could even change the background, like, the set and shit, so it doesn't look like everyone's recording the shit in the same day, you know?
Yeah. And then Sean could get good at learning how to, he teaches himself cartoons, and then, you know, he could have a workshop at Jester teaching other comics how to use this program and how to make their own cartoons, you know?
That'd be fucking great, yeah.
Right.
Like, we also, like, would love that, to bring people in, like, that, to help us all with the business of comedy and shit. How to do this, how to do that, how to, you know... But talk to bookers and what the bookers are looking for and this and that. You know, that'd be cool shit. But, an electronic press kit. We don't know how to do that. A lot of us don't know how to do that. So, like, how to make one of those. Yeah, the electronic press kit is like, you know, it's like your headshots, your clips, your credits, also, yeah, like a bunch of shit, pretty much like a little packet that will sell you. So you send it into like an agency or something like that, and then they go, okay, Sean McDonough, and they look through the shit. Okay, he's been on, you know, he's been on Punk'd, he's been on fucking Gilmore Girls, whatever the fuck. It's just going down, okay, this is credits, this is stand-up, this is how many follows he has, this is how many likes, views, da-da-da-da.
It's so like a dynamic electronic resume kind of thing.
Yeah.
And I know about screenwriting. I can donate my time and expertise in that field for writing sketches and stuff like that. So I like the idea, Jester, and I love myself some Franco Danger. So thanks for putting that together, Sean, and you know, raising up this community together, you know.
You're welcome. Thanks for fucking giving me spots and just being funny and just being good people to spend time on the phone with and shit. Like, everything else aside, that's so important. Like, like yesterday I called Franco and I just, like, it was the hardest I laughed all day. And we were just talking about bullshit. He wasn't even paying attention. He was playing Fortnite the whole time.
Dude, can we mention what we talked about yesterday?
Absolutely. Yeah.
Okay. So it wasn't until, when was that show, first of all?
That show was, I think it was at least a month ago. I think it was March 7th. It might have been it was the last thing I did before the fucking state got shut down, for sure.
Dude, so March 7th, right? Sean goes on stage, right? We're on a show together. Sean goes on stage. He has a bit, super funny, and then he ends up singing this song, right? And in the song, there's a lyric. Can you describe the lyric?
Yeah, it's the song is Hennessy and Ecstasy by BG, featuring the Big Timers, and the lyric that I sang, which is actually different than what I thought it was, but it goes, I've been popping Hennessy, or I've been popping Ecstasy, I've been drinking Hennessy. There's a naked chick next to me. Now, when I sang it on stage, I said, I've been popping ecstasy, drinking Hennessy. There's a naked bitch next to me.
So when Sean did that on stage, right?
Yeah.
I didn't think he said naked. I thought he said the N-word.
and you're the second person that said that to me.
And I'm almost positive, so did the whole room.
Yeah, because they just see they see his little white supremacist mustache wiggle on that N word, you know, any word that starts with an N, and they're like, I know what he said,
bro. And the funny thing is that if he would have said the N word, it would have still made sense, like an N word, bitch, like someone else's bitch next to me, made sense, dude. We died, bro. That shit was so funny, because it was so unexpected, and it was just like, that's the lyric, I guess so, and it was just so fucking funny, and then somehow it just came up yesterday, and I was like, yeah, you said the N-word on stage, and he was like, no, I didn't. He's like, you're the second person that told me that, and I was like, you didn't? I thought, dude, do you understand that I've thought about that at least 3 times since that day? And I was like, man, Sean got away with it, bro. I was like, poor Kramer. People love him, but he didn't get away with that. But Sean, he got away with it. Fucking Indiana Jones.
What you said, though, the funny thing was, you said it was like, I watched you and you were smiling. I'm like, you didn't say it with hate in your heart.
Yeah, you did. That's why the whole crowd laughed, because they were like, this guy loves this song.
Yeah, like he's just referencing what somebody else did, and he likes black girls. What's wrong with that?
Yeah, bro. Dude, it was just so funny. It was even funny to find out that he didn't say it. But, like, I remember the guy next to me, a friend of mine next to me, a comic, after Sean said it, he looked over at me, he was like, oh, that was his laugh.
Oh. We're not supposed to hear that.
Yeah. There's a difference. There's a difference in the laughs. If it was a ha-ha, I would have been like, oh, that's a good lyric. But that's definitely,
The Yeah, and I remember, and that dude fucking, I never met him before, and he's like, yo, good shit, and gave me a dab, and I was like, okay.
Yeah.
But I think also yesterday you said, I think that you said that I have a list of white people that can get away with it, and I guess you're on it or something.
Yeah, he just made the list, probably, oh shit.
And he got dapped by the host, who's a black guy, so, I mean, you know.
Yeah.
What other cosign do you need?
And that was great too, because now the next time I do that story on stage, I have like an extra couple minutes where I can discuss that. Like, you know what I mean? Like, it was like that is the coolest shit about having like comedian friends or whatever. It's like, you know, like now it's like I have like more to what I was talking about before from it.
Yeah, and also talking about seeing your friend bomb, it's to me, I like when I see a comic do well with a bit in one setting, and then, like, the stakes are raised, and now it's like a teacher's union fundraiser, like you were saying, and you see them start to go into the bit, but they're not getting laughs, so this confidence from when they got laughs before starts to melt in the room where they're not, it's not working this time, but you know what they're trying to do. To me, that's what I love, where it's like, no, I've seen this bit kill before. It's not working tonight. You're trying to use it like a gangly hedge clipper, and it's just not fucking working.
Yeah, dude. Oh, I love watching that shit, though.
Yeah.
It's funnier for me when it's a comedian, like you said it, though, when it's a comedian, like, it's not funny, like, it's not so funny to me if it's somebody that, like, I've never seen do well. Mm-hmm. But if it's like somebody that I've seen do well before eat a dick, it is hilarious.
Oh yeah, it's so fun, especially if they're close to you. You can like just talk shit. There was times where I'll never forget, bro. Like with Q, me and Q would hit mics up all the time, quiet and cool, and super funny. But then like there was times where there was a point where he was in the beginning, he was habitually running the light. He was just running the light. And he didn't even know he was running the light. He was just in the moment. So just to fuck with him, like when he would run the light, we're like, yo, what the fuck are you doing? You're not filming a special or whatever. That's how we started. And then he would keep running the light. So then we would hold our phones up with the Netflix logo and give him the light with the Netflix logo. So it'd be me with the Netflix. Someone else had the HBO logo on. And we're just like flashing them. Dude. It'd be so much fun to just talk shit. Like, I would bomb, and then I'd get off stage, and Khalif was like, yo, that's a hell of a TED Talk up there, but that was good shit, you know? And then, like, you know, like, it's just, that's fun too, man. I feel like, I think we talked about this before, Eric, on the podcast, but, like, having a squad of people that are just really honest with you, like, if you ate shit, and you get off stage, and they're like, yo, you ate shit, but then, that's cool. But also a group of people that will talk to you about why they think that you ate shit when you're up there, that's a different story. Like, that's cool as shit.
Yeah, where it's like, it's like, you know, you could, you know, see a 3-year comic and you're like a 6-year comic and you're like, you know what, I made that mistake too. And they're like, why didn't this work? It worked 2 days ago. What the fuck? And you're like, yeah, but you kind of start with this. Look at all these church ladies. You know what I mean? They're not going to go for
your...
you know, gay Jesus joke, it's not going to work. So if you start with your poo material, because everybody shits, so then that could be more that to get them to like you before you go into this, or just, you know, it's, oh, I had a long talk with Tito one time about, like, look, it's not about, like, I will never compromise and, like, try to do a clean set. Like, when certain managers of clubs tell you, oh, can you work clean? It's like, can you fuck your fucking mom's tits right now? Like, go die somewhere. But because it's like, especially if you know that club, like, hires Jim Norton all the time to headline. It's like, what are you talking about? Like, you have Jim Norton here, who's the dirtiest comic in the world. But if it's a bunch of church ladies in the front, I don't want to bomb. Like, bombing is not... I don't want to have so much integrity that I fucking bomb all the time and I divorce reality of being funny. But yeah. can adjust, instead of using this joke, they're not going to like any of these jokes. So let me use these jokes. So when you have like 60 minutes of material to choose from, it's like, just pick the bit that's going to work the best in the situation, you know? So you still have integrity and you're not like changing, but you're not doing bits that are just going to piss everybody off, you know?
Yeah.
That's like, did you ever hear that Mike Birbiglia bit about when he started out? And he's like, somebody asked him to do 30 minutes, and he's like, yeah, I'll do it. And he had, like, he's like, I had 11 minutes.
Yeah.
And he's like, and then he's like, and I go up on stage, and 4 minutes later, I get off stage and apologize to everybody. Like, I had a situation. There was this kid in Oregon that threw this show at this, it was this food cart park or whatever. And basically what it was like an airplane hangar with like a bar on the inside, and then there was food trucks ringing around it. And it was still probably the biggest show that I've ever done. And like 350, 400 people in this place, right? Loud, the lights are on. It's not like the best place to do comedy. And I did the same set 2 weeks apart, and one time absolutely killed, and then the second time got booed off stage. You know?
Damn.
Like,
that's crazy.
Like, it was like, I even recorded it, right? I was like, was my timing off? Like, whatever it was, like, it was a little bit, but it was just like, it was, that was what, but, like, had I been paying attention to different things, I would have noticed, like, the second time that I did it, I was on stage earlier, and everybody still had their kids there and shit like that. You know what I mean? So I can't open up with my joke about, like, you know, sending rescued dogs to the kids at the Mexican border so that they have company when there's, like, you know, fucking 50 Mexican families with their kids there. Like, obviously it's not going to work in that room, you know?
Yeah. I had something like that happen to me where I was asked to do 10 minutes and I had like a loose six, you know, and I did it in New York and I bombed my ass off, bro, with that fucking medium type five loose six. So let's say it's a medium type five, right? It was just like lightly padded, you know, five. So I ate a shit on stage. Like, the thugs in the front seat, I mean, in the front the table, and they were just like, yo, you're about to get booed. The owner of the club is saying, Frank will get the fuck off stage in the middle of my set. People are fucking sighing. Fucking people are like, the ice is melting, and I can hear it in the fucking ice buckets. It's a fucking, no bullshit. A woman put a fucking sparkler in a bottle, bro. And then walk that shit around the whole audience because it was somebody's fucking birthday or some shit. Someone ordered bottle service. So halfway through my set, I just hear tsss. I'm like, what the fuck is that? And it's the biggest distraction. It's the worst thing that ever happened. Post gets on stage, fucking apologizes to the crowd after me and says, sorry, you know, sometimes we bring brand new comedians out here to test them, you know, to figure out how they do, blah, blah, blah. And I fucking, that's the worst bomb I ever had in my life. Like, I walked off mid-sentence the minute I saw the light. I walked off in a sentence, bro. Like, I was just like, yeah, so I was thinking, like, it's really weird. Oh, okay, all right, see you guys. Thank you so much. And I just got off. I didn't give a fuck.
Yeah, you're like, thank God.
But, yo, this is what probably kept me in comedy, right? It was this moment. I ate so much shit on stage. I got off, and I was pissed. And I see these veteran comics in the corner. That's where we're all hanging out, right? These comics have been doing it for a long time. I start walking closer to that corner. They are cracking up. They are laughing that I bombed so hard, right? Because the host even didn't do the job. Host went on stage before me, did a minute, pulled me up, right? So they're dying, right? I walk up. I'm pissed, like, why the fuck are these motherfuckers dying? The one guy comes up to me. He's like, yo, man. Dabs me up. He's like, that was ass, bro. That was ass. Dabs me up. but then hugs me. And he goes, welcome to the club, man. Welcome to the club. And another guy comes in and says, yo, dude, fuck, bro. That was brutal, man. Welcome, though. Come on. Like, you're on your stripe tonight. And they all said the same shit. They told me it was ass. And they all said, like, they all said something like, you earned your stripe. Like, you, something good. Like, you know, it was a good thing that happened. Like, welcome to the club. This is what the game is about. this is what happens, da 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 da. And I think it was done on purpose, right? But to set me up for failure. But literally the next day, same jokes, same 5 minutes, won me first place in a fucking competition, a new talent competition. Yeah. So it's like that dynamic, bro. It's just like, holy shit. So like, lows to lows. You can go from super lows to super high real quick, bro. It's weird. This is an abusive relationship.
It is. It's so funny because it's like, it is like lightning in a bottle, you know? It's like the three comics before you, the content of their material, the social dynamic going on in politics, plus everyone in the room, the reason for being there. I mean, it's like this moving target. And if you can be consistent under moving circumstances of different venues, you know, it's crazy.
Yeah.
But I think that's it. I did an hour with Sean before Franco popped up, so we got to end this podcast. It's almost 2 hours.
Okay. Word. All right.
All right.
All right. But all right. I love you both. This has been episode 250 of Highway Diary with Sean McDonough and Franco Danger talking about the Jester fundraiser.
Yeah.
Later.
Yeah.